Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with conflicting reports on who used chemical weapons in Syria and speak with veteran foreign correspondent Rhys Ehrlich, the author of Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence and Empire. We'll discuss efforts to get irrefutable proof of the use of chemical weapons by the independent UN International Commission of Inquiry that has been repeatedly denied entry into Syria by the Assad regime. Then we'll look into the regional turmoil following Israeli strikes on Syria that have escalated the proxy war between Iran and Israel. Aram Nagizian, a senior fellow at the Center for Strategic and International Studies and author of Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects for War, joins us to discuss growing pressure on the U.S. to intervene and why neighboring Turkey is increasingly reluctant to get involved in a war that they mistakenly calculated would have ended some time ago. Then finally, we will examine whether an unlikely government agency, the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC, will stem the tide of unregulated money flowing into our elections following the Supreme Court's Citizens United decision. Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School specializing in election law, campaign finance, and ethics, joins us to discuss her article at the Sacramento Bee, "Will the SEC Save Us from Citizens United?" And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iran, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you so much, Ian.
And what do you make of these conflicting reports, obviously initial reports of the use of chemical weapons, in particular sarin, originally attributed to the regime, and then Carla Del Ponte, UN former war crimes prosecutor and member of the commission, told a Swiss public radio that the rebels may have used chemical weapons, and now the commission itself, the International Commission on Inquiry, the UN Commission, have refuted what she said. So what do you make of it all?
Well, it shows you how highly politicized the issue is that a lot is riding on whether you think there was chemical weapons or not and who used them. And there's a growing hubbub in Washington to engage in some kind of military attack on Syria, and the chemical weapons would offer the perfect excuse. I think let's go back over what some of the claims are. The Israeli government and the U.S. government, CIA, have said that they are confident that there was sarin gas used in Syria, and it was by the Assad regime. They've not offered any actual proof of it. In fact, some of the details that have leaked out look pretty suspicious. For example, the Israeli general who made the statement said that they had video of people foaming at the mouth. Well, foaming at the mouth is not one of the characteristics of sarin gas. And a Global Post article recently, just yesterday, discovered that at least one of the incidents where the sarin gas was supposedly used, the medics, when they checked the blood samples, this was in Turkey, found no traces of sarin gas, and they didn't exhibit the symptoms of sarin gas. So there's a lot, as we remember from the run-up to the Iraq War, there was a lot of fudging and outright manipulation of data to get people very, very scared about Saddam Hussein, and I think we're seeing the same process going on in the U.S. now about Syria.
But sarin actually is not a gas. It's a chemical. If it hits
the
skin,
it become a vapor.
Vapor, but the actual contact with your skin is almost instant death.
Right. Well, if it's in heavy enough dosage, absolutely.
Yeah. So but one of the reasons why one is suspicious of the Syrian government is that their repeated denials of repeated attempts on the part of the UN Independent International Commission of Inquiry on the Syrian Arab Republic, as its official title is. They've been trying to get in and offer irrefutable proof one way or the other, and the Assad government continually blocks them.
Yeah. As your listeners know, and as you know from previous interviews we've done, I'm no fan of the Assad government, and I'm highly critical of his dictatorship. But I think what they're sitting in Damascus, they're worried that if they give an open-ended permission for a UN inspectors to come in, they could see a rerun of what happened in Iraq, where you know, the U.S. is now known to have planted homing devices and done all kinds of illegal activities that later aided in the U.S. war effort against Iraq. And I think the Syrian government wants to limit it. And it could be that they've got something else they want to hide that they're afraid the inspectors might come across that don't have anything to do with the chemical weapons.
But there's never been much logic in the first place for the regime to use chemical weapons unless they were sort of testing the resolve or something, and that's hard to believe.
Yeah, it's hard. It's usually, you know, I use a pretty good rule of thumb in my reporting. If it doesn't make sense politically, then it doesn't make sense, and it makes absolutely no sense for Assad right now to use chemical weapons. In fact, the opposite might be true of the rebels, or a faction of the rebels, becoming so desperate they want to gin up a U.S. attack. Just in the last few days, there have been real setbacks for the rebels in Damascus and Homs and a number of other cities. Chemical weapons, Assad is not stupid. I've interviewed him twice. He's a very shrewd character, evil, but very shrewd. And he knows that if he uses chemical weapons, it's the excuse the West has been waiting for to come in and flatten his regime and kill him. So it makes no sense politically for him to do that. And you don't test out using chemical weapons to see if the West goes for it. And then if they don't anything, you do it, then you use more chemical weapons. I mean, that's just absurd. That's the kind of logic that comes out of Washington, but it's unrelated to the real world.
Well, it also, though, doesn't make a lot of sense. At least there's not much probability that the rebels would have sarin. They're a non-state actor, and they're in various factions, and it would be hard to figure out how they get hold of it.
I agree, and that's why, you know, the Assad government's claims that the rebels were using chemical agents don't make a lot of sense either. It's possible that they're trying to mimic the use of sarin or some by using some other chemicals. It's possible that people were reacting to tear gas. You know, a heavy dose of tear gas in a closed area can cause a lot of very bad symptoms and even death. So it's simply unclear. I would be very interested in what the Carla Del Ponte's group has come up with that led her to make her statement.
And again, I'm speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy, and The Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Now, clearly, there's a possibility here that, well, first of all, just in terms of personalities, Netanyahu, the Israeli Prime Minister, I think has obviously wanted his friend to become the president, Mitt Romney, and doesn't much like Obama. And I think probably, at least I've been hearing reports that they sort of have kind of contempt for him. There was a very macho statement from an Israeli former head of Israeli military intelligence, a general, who said to Israel radio over the weekend that, you know, when we have a red line with Iran, we really mean it. But the Americans are kind of, you know, squishy about their red lines, referring to the White House being kind of gutless. So, I mean, how much is this just a sort of macho on the part of the Israelis, or are they really trying to push the administration into action?
Oh, I think they're trying to provoke the U.S. I mean, on what grounds does Israel have to carry out bombing raids inside Syria, a sovereign country? They claim they're stopping missiles from being shipped to Hezbollah, but they make that claim about everything. There was apparently 100 Revolutionary Guard soldiers killed in Damascus at a military headquarters. What does that have to do with missiles to Hezbollah? What's really going on is that Israel would like to see the U.S. and probably Britain and France set up a military attack on Syria, which would be to Israel's advantage, although I think, frankly, it's going to cause more problems for Israel in the long run. But I guess apparently their short-term thinking is get rid of Assad, put in some kind of pliant government in Syria, and that Israel will be better off. But they're playing with fire. They did that in Lebanon, and the result was Hezbollah. You know, so it's not in Israel's interest to provoke yet another conflict in the region.
Well, but it also not in Israel's interest to turn this conflict into an Arab-Israeli conflict. That's the very thing that Assad wants, and he's been wanting ever long, for all along. In fact, the rebels have always accused Assad of being too soft on the Israelis.
Yes. Well, that is the dirty little secret about the uprising in Syria, is that nobody supports Israel in Syria. Everybody in Syria wants the Golan back, and where it was seized in 1967 by Israel. And it's a matter of tactically how hard do they want to fight against Israel at this time, etc. Yeah, I think unfortunately, I think the Israel has made an accurate calculation that Assad is so weak that he even a two-day assault on the Damascus airport, on one of his military headquarters, etc., that he's too weak to be able to respond. He simply politically and militarily now, he can't fire missiles back at Israel. I doubt that Hezbollah is going to do that, although that's a possibility. And so I think the Israelis are calculating that that Assad is so weak, he can't turn it into an Israel versus Arab war.
But there were so many secondary explosions in these attacks on the airport in Damascus and on the facilities around Mount Kaisun, where the Revolutionary Guards have their headquarters. And, of course, the 4th Division is run by Maher Assad, the brutal brother of Bashar al-Assad. So what explains the enormous secondary explosions?
Well, I think they hit military stores. You know, I'm sure they hit munitions. Right. That doesn't mean they were missiles on their way to Hezbollah. That's the excuse that Israel has used. It claimed had bombed a nuclear weapons site or one that was about to be developed a few years ago. I mean, they come up with a reason to bomb and then come up with some excuse to justify it. I'm sure they hit some kind in the nuclear strike or so-called nuclear strike. They hit a military target. It just wasn't a nuclear one. And in this case, I think they hit military targets that may or may not have had anything to do with Hezbollah.
So what is John McCain up to then, going on Fox News on Sunday and basically deriding the administration, saying, you know, the administration won't have a no-fly zone over Syria, but the Israelis can fly in there and bomb at will. So, you know, what's their problem?
Well, that's because that's because Israel is our ally, so anything they do is okay. I guess these guys don't bother to read the news about what's happening in Libya. You know, I mean, this is the scenario. You go in, you have a no-fly zone. It still took them 7 months to get rid of Gaddafi. And while there's an elected parliament and a prime minister, the real power in Libya is the militias. And they killed the U.S. ambassador. They blew up the French embassy. Is that what they want to see happen in Syria as well? So you have yet one more destabilized Middle Eastern country with the danger of right-wing extremists using Islam as their excuse. That's what McCain is basically advocating.
Well, he's also, I think, downplaying the complicated nature of a no-fly zone. It's one thing to lob some standoff missiles from Lebanese airspace into Syria. It's another thing to have a round-the-clock air umbrella over a country. That's a huge undertaking.
And what does it do to the people of Syria? I mean, that apparently doesn't count. The numbers of Syrian civilians who will be killed in this process. They're collateral damage, I guess.
Well, but, you know, the Syrian regime is fairly unconcerned about how many civilians they killed. They're lobbing bombing and lobbing Scud missiles into civilian areas.
Right, and they're wrong as well. And the fact that they're doing it doesn't justify the U.S. doing it too.
So what's your sense then of this thing, from what I can tell? And I talked to a Syrian yesterday who said that the Assads have issued Plan B, which is for the Alawites to move to their ancestral homes in the mountains on the Mediterranean coast, and they're digging in there, and that's what the ethnic cleansing of those Sunni villages is about. Is that what you think is happening?
Well, I know that's an idea that's being tossed around a lot among intelligence and media folks. I don't think it's real. First of all, the number of people, you know, the Alawites are somewhere around 10% of the population in Syria. In order for something like that to succeed, they would need a way to get their weapons resupplied and their food supplies and their economy to function. And there's no major power willing to do that. You can't survive on your own, surrounded by hostile powers, including Israel and presumably the new rebel government in Syria and so on. So I, whether or not Assad is planning for that, which I've not seen any convincing evidence of, but let's even say he is, there's no way that that's going to survive. Because there's not enough, there's no outside power. Iran can't do it. Russia is not about to do it. And there's nobody else around.
Yeah, but it's better than being dead, isn't it?
Well, that may be his plan, but, you know, Gaddafi's plan was to hightail it into the desert, and look what happened to him.
Well, so is this to say then, Reese Ehrlich, that this, the agony will go on?
Well, I mean, I have stopped predicting what's going to happen in Syria. You know, when I was there, people told me it would be over in a matter of 3 months, and that was quite some time ago. I think the most dangerous thing that can happen is further foreign military intervention. It's going to escalate things beyond the horrors that are going on now and make it much worse. Eventually, the people of Syria will resolve this themselves.
Well, there's no indication that Obama wants to get involved, and I think he's reading the polls properly, isn't he? The American people are war-weary, and Iraq is a disaster, and it's going to looks like it's the civil war is going to resume there, and Afghanistan is a complete disaster, and those generals who advocated the surge ought to be tried for as war criminals. I mean, they absolutely achieved nothing and just killed a whole bunch of U.S. servicemen Indeed. And women.
Indeed. I think President Obama and the kind of, shall we say, what passes for doves these days in Washington want to see Assad overthrown, but they want to do it with a light U.S. footprint. So they're arming the rebels, but they're doing it through Saudi Arabia and Qatar. And Turkey. They want to see a new government that's pro-U.S., but they have not been able to come up with anybody that's reliable in that regard. The hawks in Washington, which includes some people within the administration, and, for example, John Kerry and others, they want to see a direct military intervention under the guise of a no-fly zone. So far, Obama, I think, has correctly resisted that. But he's still playing with fire by all these CIA activities that are going on today.
But the U.S. is in no way on the same page as Saudi Arabia. That's one of the incredible blindnesses in our foreign policy, that we somehow still think that the Saudis are our friends. When they created the Taliban, they've destabilized Pakistan. They're bringing al-Qaeda into Syria. I mean, they've turned Islam into at least not the religion itself, but their version of Islam is incredibly militant and xenophobic and austere. And I can't believe that we don't see that the writing on the wall. The Saudis are supporting the al-Qaeda types.
They are indeed, although officially they're supporting the moderate and nationalist forces. That's what they told me when I was in Saudi Arabia and what they're officially telling the U.S. No, I think the problem is the U.S. doesn't have a lot of options, and allowing Saudi Arabia and Qatar and Turkey to arm the rebels is a way the U.S. claims it's not being directly involved, but then it gives freedom to those countries to arm the rebels that they like, who may or may not be in the same interest as the United States. And it is the pickle that a weakened empire faces. In the old days, you know, 20, 30 years ago, they would have just landed the troops and stayed there for as long as until the guerrilla war forced them out. Obama is trying to do the traditional kind of boots-on-the-ground U.S. Intervention, but it then weakens his ability to do other things.
So are we then to be thankful that George W. Bush hastened the end of the empire?
I'm I'm going to have to visit his museum, you know, his presidential library, to figure that one out. apparently there's interactive games about what decision would you have made. Yes, I think George Bush, not intentionally, of course, but did with particularly the Iraq War and the Afghanistan War, has done more to damage the U.S. empire than any president in recent history.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rees Erlich.
Thank you, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Rees Erlich, a veteran foreign correspondent who reports regularly for CBC, ABC Australia, Radio Deutsche Welle, and NPR. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the regional implications of Israel's strike on Syria.
Politician and them war is not the answer. To know what the solution Rasta says. War is not the answer. Let the politician and them start drop them bomb. War is not the answer. To know what the solution Rasta says.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Aram Nagizian, who is a senior fellow with the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored or co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. Welcome to Background Briefing, Aram Nagizian.
Happy to be here, Ian.
And, of course, apropos the title of your last book, Prospects of War, Syria, of course, is calling the Israeli strikes on Damascus Airport on Friday and then early Sunday morning strikes on both the Revolutionary Guards, 4th Division headquarters of the brother of the president, as well as other facilities, an act of war.
Well, the book we put out on Israel and Syria is somewhat ominous. It draws a pattern of two countries who have adopted different strategies militarily, but there's one consistent theme, which is that the Syrians have consistently tried to play down any act of overt escalation. And the Israelis, in turn, have had a focus on establishing and maintaining their own red lines on things like aid transfers to Hezbollah and so on. So what you have over the course of the last decade, going back to Israeli strikes on targets in 2003, and of course, the 2007 strike on that reactor, which is the backdrop of our book on Israel and Syria, and also more recently raids against alleged transfers to Hezbollah in January and more recently last week. What you have is a cycle where the Israelis seem to have an appropriate response without trying to push the Assad regime up the escalation ladder. With none of these major incidents, have you seen a dramatic turn to military action? You see a lot of rhetoric coming out of Damascus. You saw it then. You certainly see it now. But the environment has changed. The civil war is such that even more pressure exists on Assad to think very long and hard about what the best response is. And while many are concerned that maybe because of the civil war, Assad might choose to do something vis-a-vis Israel, the reality is that he doesn't have a lot of options in front of him to deal with that particular threat.
And, of course, Israel has been silent, and the Israeli prime minister is on his way to China and John Kerry's on his way to Moscow. There's no way in the world that this is not getting broader implications than just the regional players. And my sense is that the Israeli strikes may start making this conflict in Syria an Arab-Israeli conflict, which, of course, is what Assad's been saying all along. Wouldn't that put the U.S. in a position that they'd have to try and prevent that from happening?
Well, it's certainly true that Assad and his allies have tried to frame this as a war against terrorists who benefit or who are aligned with Israel. That does tie in with the very real pattern of regional Sunni-Shiite competition that is taking place between Saudi Arabia and Iran. Now, whether or not one can paint this in the context of a future Arab-Israeli war, well, there are a couple of indicators to keep in mind. The first is you're not going to have a major war decision by the Israelis with an absence at the top in terms of government leadership. The fact that Netanyahu is traveling to China, and the fact that you have this plausible deniability that the IDF continues to turn to, and the fact that you've had a U.S. preference for very, very limited escalation in the Levant seems to show that at least there's an intent to not escalate to regional war. But that's all good and well on the U.S., Israeli, and Western side. The other question is, well, how is everybody else looking at this? Well, one of the big feelers I got from contacts in Lebanon was that Hezbollah in particular was drawing a correlation between Israeli military maneuvers in northern Israel and on the Golan Heights and statements coming out of the White House on Syrian chemical weapons. Now, for those of us who are here in the U.S., you know, we can unpack that and, you know, find the nuance. But if you are the Assad regime or if you're Hezbollah or Iran, there's a very real risk of misinterpretation. And there's a real perception that somehow the West and their allies in the region, critically Israel, are gearing up for what Hezbollah considers to be its worst-case scenario, a three-pronged war as it battles against the opposition in Qusair, deals with the Israelis at the military level along the blue line, and something that would never have been possible before the civil war in Syria, which is the risk of a flanking maneuver by Israeli forces from the Golan. So all of these things tie together. You don't have a U.S. preference for escalation. You have a preference for managing instability in the Levant. That being said, local forces, whether they are the Israelis, the Syrians, or Hezbollah, are dealing with local dynamics, and that's where the risk lies.
And again, I'm speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a senior fellow with the Arleigh Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. His latest book is Israel and Syria, The Military Balance and the Prospects of War. Now, whether or not the Israelis are pushing the United States into a more assertive role vis-a-vis Syria, there's certainly indications from the former head of Israeli military intelligence who made a statement over the weekend to Israeli radio that was sort of derisive of America, saying that we in Israel, when we make a red line with Iran, we mean it, as opposed to the squishy Americans. John McCain, of course, on Sunday went on the Fox News Sunday basically sniping at the administration, saying that, you know, the Israelis seem to be able to have establish a no-fly zone over Syria and go in there with impunity, so why can't we? So there's no question that, at least in terms of the political opposition here in the United States, the White House is under pressure.
Well, you have two key patterns to keep in mind. The first is that countries like Israel, again, they exist in an environment that is very much tied to their immediate near abroad. So Syria is critical to the regional security architecture that Israel would like to have in place. And that's something that's very different from, say, the U.S., which is a global superpower that has a number of issues it's focused on, one of which being Syria. The other problem is a problem that many administrations have faced, which is that more often than not, the U.S. fails to communicate effectively, and when it does communicate, it's often misunderstood. Whether it's the statement by Obama, which apparently now it seems might have been an off-the-cuff remark, that is not the exception. You do have other instances like this. For example, a press statement being misconstrued as something of a doctrine in the case of the Nixon administration. So you do have this problem. If you don't communicate properly at a time when you have overlapping pressures and constraints, you open yourself up to domestic pressures, and you open yourself up to being misinterpreted by your allies and your opponents, which is why you've seen an effort by this administration to try and get ahead of the CW, chemical weapons issue in Syria. Because the reality, and this is to show where some of the nuance in Senator McCain's statements tends to fall off the wayside, is that you can do something in Syria for a range of issues, but you can't do one thing that addresses all of the problems that the U.S. wants to address. You can take out and completely destroy a chemical weapons plant, but you can't end the civil war by doing that. You can provide military aid, lethal aid to the rebels, but you're not addressing the chemical weapons proliferation issue. And buffer zones don't do anything to change the fact that this is a existential war for both the Alawites and the Sunnis. So when you do think about doing some things in Syria, it's going to have to be in a much more pragmatic environment. It'll be an environment where the U.S. behaves in such a way as to defend its interests. But defending those interests might mean losing popularity contests in the Middle East. And that might be where we're slowly shifting in the debate.
And Aram Nagezian, I mean, you mentioned the chemical weapons issue, which is the red line that maybe Obama was a little off the cuff with. And there have been some piling on about whether his bluff is being called. And, of course, the intelligence community and the administration are saying they're not sure about what actually happened. And most indications are that if there's anything to it, that it would have been the Syrian regime itself who possessed these weapons, particularly sarin. But now you've got the UN official, Khalid al-Ponte, saying that sarin was used by the rebels. So now it's even more confusing.
Well, look, the confusion in this conflict is not new to civil wars in the Arab world. I mean, no one remembers why the Japanese Red Army was a supporter of one faction or another during the Lebanese Civil War, and that lasted 15 years. The dynamics of ambiguity, reporting, the inability to get an accurate picture, and to confuse hypothesis for fact is something that you're going to see in Syria. And you might have noticed, and some of your listeners surely might have seen some of this already, you already have the UN walking back from that position. That doesn't mean that they are saying something conclusive. It just mirrors the problems that the Obama administration is facing with, which is to say that there are no facts. You do not have definitive facts in this conflict. You have assessments. You have estimates. You have an idea how well the rebels are doing. You have a rebel force that is adapting. You have a regime that is adapting. And everyone else is trying to keep up. And none of these things happen in real time in terms of the open source. And even in the intelligence community, the assessments are anything but optimal. And given the lessons of past military action, and I'm not just talking about Iraq and the environment in the intelligence community before that, I'm also talking about Lebanon, where you had a U.S. military engagement which rapidly escalated under the effect of mission creep, where U.S. forces quickly became part of the scenery of a civil war. These are all environments that the U.S. is keen to avoid. This is an era of austerity. This is an era of sequestration. And wars of choice are going to become increasingly rare when they're mass-scaled. They have to be wars of necessity. Right now, the big question is, do you have the preconditions for a clear response with all the facts and the ability to build a coalition? And the jury is still out because the intelligence is just not there yet.
And Aram Nagezian, when you say that the reality is it's an existential struggle between the Sunni and the Alawite minority, it looks as though the Assads and the Alawites are starting to institute Plan B, which is to ethnic cleanse the northwestern ancestral area of the Alawites and to kind of create a redoubt to retreat. And so if that's the case, then the situation is going to harden. There's no negotiation anymore, is there? There'll either be partition or endless war or both.
Well, the post-Ottoman social contract in Syria has essentially collapsed. And the only thing holding that together was this Ba'athi Arabist ideology and state structure that the Assads had founded in the first place. Before that, you had civil war and instability. Now what you have is basically an Alawite regime that is basically learning from some of the most difficult lessons of sectarian war fighting in the Lebanese Civil War. In Lebanon's Civil War, the ruling Maronites at the beginning of the conflict splintered off into competing militias, which in the end engaged in a fratricidal war amongst themselves and then lost power. What the Alawites have done under Assad is the opposite, which is to tell able men who could come and join the fight that if you want to fight the Sunnis, if you want to fight for your autonomy, if you want to fight for your family, do it here. This is the address, the Assad regime, the military, the popular militias, and the National Defense Forces. And what that's created is a force that is ideological and that will not defect. Those that are Sunni and that are still in the ranks don't stand much from defecting anyway and have made their bed, in essence. And that's part of another cycle, which is that there's such a thing as the regime. And when you have this pattern of a civil war where you have a Sunni majority with an uprising that has seen rebel factions learn in the battlefield, you also have an Assad military and allied factions that have also learned after 2 years of fighting. And if they have to execute some kind of a strategy that guarantees the survival of minority communities, and if there is the real threat of a winner-take-all conflict, then from their point of view, so be it. Now, are we talking partition? Are we talking soft partition, which is to say an environment where the borders stay the same, but for all intents and purposes, you have more homogenous zones like in Iraq, or whether you're going to have some kind of a new social contract under external support and reconciliation is difficult to say. You don't have fatigue yet. You have competing sides that both think they're winning. In different arenas of the conflict, both sides have made key victories. And I think we live in an environment with Twitter and Facebook and instant media that we assume civil wars will end quickly. But the pattern for the past century has been that they take at least 4 or 5 years, if not more. So we should expect that this battle for Syria, or a Syria divided, or a Syria partitioned, will drag on at least for some more time to come.
And Aram Nagizian, if at some point or other pressure on Obama, either from Israel or from John McCain and others, gets to the point of this idea of a no-fly zone, which I think McCain is making sound a lot easier than it is, because it's one thing to do targeted strikes against facilities. It's another thing to have 24-hour round-the-clock an air canopy over the country that's bristling with some of the latest Soviet ground-to-air missiles. It would also involve cooperation with Turkey. Where do things stand with Turkey? Because you would think on the surface, if anybody has an interest in stability in its south, it'd be Turkey. And if anybody could ever have some sort of stabilizing force in a post-civil war scenario in Syria, it would be Turkey.
Well, first, to address Turkey, I mean, the assumption overarchingly in Ankara at the beginning of the crisis was that it would be quick, it would be relatively bloodless, it would be a unique opportunity for Turkey to maintain a zero-problems policy, albeit while gaining additional leverage in a Sunni-majority country. One has to remember this is in the context of the Muslim Brotherhood-affiliated AK party running predominantly in Turkish politics. Now, none of those assumptions have borne fruit. This has been a protracted conflict along a long border with Turkey. It's not going to end easily or well. Yes, you have a Sunni-majority population, but you have the burden of the Ottoman and neo-Ottoman legacies of Turkish foreign policy that do still resonate with minority groups in the region, certainly with Christians, and now by default with the Alawites, who view Turkey as being on the side of community in Syria that would prefer to become dominant rather than share power. Yes, I agree. Assad has done everything to make Syria reach a point where power sharing is the last thing on the mind of the Sunni factions. And this is a self-inflicted wound. But that doesn't change the fact that Turkey has inherited a conflict on its border, which it never expected it would. And this complicates future cooperation. Turkey is used to garrison operations in terms of military posture and is used to fighting the PKK and Kurdish elements. The last major military engagement that they undertook was in the 70s vis-a-vis Cyprus. And there is no contemporary parallel to that when you look at Syria. It would be an environment where if Turkey were more exposed or had to engage militarily, it would expose itself to risk. It would also expose the political factions ruling the country to a reassertion by the military. The other question which you, in essence, pointed to is, isn't this more complicated than everyone's making it out to be? Well, to maintain military operations like the ones you described, either a no-move or a no-fly zone, it's one thing for the Israelis to lob arsenal while over Lebanon, over a glide slope into Syria, in order to execute a small strike. A major no-fly zone operation would require at least two aircraft carriers, would require basing and support in Arab states and Turkey, would complicate the security of countries in the Gulf by association. Because if you have escalation by the U.S. in Syria, there is at least preliminary indications that maybe Turkey will feel pressure, that Iran will escalate in the Gulf, could compete directly with U.S. forces. If and when you have mission creep and you actually have boots on the ground directly within Syria, none of these things will actually end the civil war, and none of these things will actually change the fact that this country has come apart at the seams, and you don't have any of the meaningful pressure points to reverse course in a way that removes Assad and guarantees Syrian stability. So logistically, from a financial standpoint, militarily, it's extremely difficult. Doesn't mean it can't be done. You just need a really good reason to do it and a reasonable expectation of success. And whether it's the U.S. or its allies, I think there's still a lot that needs to happen before you have that kind of escalation. What I think is most likely has very little to do with Turkey. Has more to do with how the U.S. tries to at least secure some of its core interests. I wouldn't be surprised if you had scenarios where you had strikes not unlike the one that the Israelis allegedly carried out, where you have the taking out of facilities, potentially chemical weapons. But ultimately, the civil war has to keep playing out until you have an opportunity where both sides or all the sides are fatigued enough, because the current balance shows forces that don't want to make major concessions. And frankly, if we're going to sit in a position where we're going to have to choose between Assad and al-Qaeda, that's anything but a favorable choice. So I suspect that some of this, at least, will continue for some time to come.
Well, Aram Nagizian, I thank you so much for joining us.
It's a pleasure, yeah.
Again, I've been speaking with Aram Nagizian, who's a senior fellow with the Ali Burke Chair in Strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, where he specializes in security, politics, and military development in the Middle East, focusing on the Lebanese military, U.S. and Iranian strategic competition in the Levant, and challenges to civil-military relations in post-conflict and divided societies. Aram Nagizian has authored and co-authored a number of reports at CSIS, including Instability in Syria, Assessing the Risks of Military Intervention, U.S.-Iranian Strategic Competition, the Proxy Cold War in the Levant, and his books include Israel and Syria, The Military Balance, and The Prospects of War. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about what the Securities and Exchange Commission can do in overturning Citizens United. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She also is the editor of the blog Pollawtics.blogspot.com and has an article at the Sacramento Bee, Will the SEC Save Us from Citizens United? Welcome to Background Briefing, Jessica Levinson.
Great to be here.
And Jessica, I've been doing some interviews lately with Michael Copps, this FCC commissioner who just left the Federal Communications Commission, and also another former FCC commissioner about how the FCC actually has in its charter the ability to get the television oligopolies and the owners of the television to force the people that pay for ads in campaigns, which is really how political campaigns are conducted nowadays, are all done through advertising. And that's what these politicians raise all the money for, is for ad buys. And the idea is that they could actually, if the FCC decided to step up to the plate, they could force these people who are putting out these campaigns to identify who's paying for them. And they don't do it because I guess they don't have the political will or whatever the reasons are. And now you come along and say there's another federal agency, an unlikely one at that, the Securities Exchange Commission, that might be able to save us from Citizens United. So lay it out for us, if you will.
Well, I will, but first I want to respond to what you said, which is that this has just been such a massive regulatory failing on so many fronts. I mean, the FCC could have done something, but also the FEC, the Federal Election Commission, really should have stepped up to the plate and reacted to the Citizens United decision, now 3 years, three plus years old, and the IRS also should have reacted to the decision. So we have really a widespread regulatory failing, and now what we're doing is turning towards the Securities Exchange Commission, as you said, not a particularly likely suspect, but the petition that's being floated is essentially asking the SEC require that corporations, when they spend political funds, that, and this is only publicly traded corporations, require that they tell their shareholders, what are you spending this money about? You know, who is it in support of? How much money is being spent? And the idea is that this would arm shareholders with the information necessary really to hold the directors and officers of publicly traded corporations accountable. It's interesting because the Citizens United decision that Justice Kennedy authored absolutely envisioned a world in which we would have this kind of disclosure. And, you know, that world has not come to fruition. And what we're looking to, you know, now is, as I said, very unlikely suspects trying to get the SEC to do part of the work here. It wouldn't go all of the way. I mean, as you know, Ian, we have massive spending by entities that are not publicly traded corporations, nonprofit entities, trade associations. So,
and the Koch brothers. I mean,
right.
private individuals and Sheldon Adelson.
That's exactly right. So this is not a panacea. This will get us part of the way, but it is hardly despite the kind of provocative title that I picked for my op-ed, it doesn't get us all of the way there.
Well, obviously corporations, I mean, one of the reasons why we have so-called balance in our media, where you have to have the pro argument and the con argument and then end up with this meaningless mush, in that's how media is structured. That comes from the newspaper owners who didn't want to offend half their readers who are Republicans and half of them who are Democrats. And the same applies, I think, for corporate CEOs. They don't want to advertise their political preferences if it's going to upset half their customers. So that there's a certain logic to that. But of course, what's happening now is with these 501c4s, these new instruments that have been brought out by Karl Rove and others, the corporations can put money in without any And when you said earlier that the IRS has failed, what's happening with all of these 501c4s that came up in the last cycle? My understanding is that the Karl Roves of this world can just apply for a 501c4, which is this vehicle by which they can funnel all this anonymous money, and then at the end of the campaign, they can dissolve it without it even being valid. Is that what's happening?
Well, that's my understanding, and that's, you know, another huge failing of the regulatory system that's happened in the wake of Citizens United, which is that we just don't have the IRS saying these are not legitimate public welfare or, you know, charitable organizations. This is not a legitimate trade association. You should not be able to organize as a 501c4 or C6 because what you are is really a political committee. You look like a political committee. You spend like a political committee, in which case we should treat you as such, and we should require that the public, and particularly the voters, get the information necessary from a political committee so that they can really evaluate the funds, which we've said is speech, that comes out of these committees, and we can decide, you know, do we want to vote for this candidate, this proposition, you know, whatever it may be. But the idea that, you know, these kind of, that these are genuine social welfare organizations, I think just simply doesn't hold water in many instances. So, you know, the IRS really should not give these organizations the benefit of tax deductible status. And that, unfortunately, has been a huge loophole that has opened up, as you know, an enormous amount of dark money just floating throughout our system, money that is spent without the ability for the public to hold those spenders accountable for what they're saying.
And again, I'm speaking with Jessica Levinson, a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She's also the editor of the blog politics.blogspot.com and has an article at the Sacramento Bee, Will the SEC Save Us from Citizens United? So maybe this is a discussion for another day, Jessica, but the idea that the Federal Elections Commission, which of course lost the suit in Citizens United, they are completely useless. I mean, Obama hasn't even put Democrats on it. I don't know what's happening with that. They've completely abdicated. The Federal Communications Commission has the ability to force advertisers to reveal force the political donors to reveal who behind their advertising on the public airwaves. They haven't done it. The IRS, as you pointed out, haven't really looked into these vehicles for dark money, these 501c4s, etc., which are complete fictions, and they don't even get to the point where they're actually they just create them for the period of the election and then dissolve them later. So it's just literally a stroke of a pen, and you can hide all those billions. So just in the last few minutes, let's talk about what the SEC can do, the Securities and Exchange Commission.
Well, so the SEC, and the big problem here is that I think, unfortunately, we are going to be telling this tale as a similar regulatory failing where I'm not sure that they have the political will to act. But what they can do is use their power to say publicly traded corporations, you know, you have to tell your shareholders when you're spending political funds. They're entitled to have this information. And, you know, as I said, Justice Kennedy in Citizens United said the solution for shareholders who are unhappy with how corporations spend money is to use the principles of corporate democracy, basically, to vote their directors and officers out. But shareholders simply don't have enough information to do that right now unless a corporation voluntarily gives this information. The petition that's filed with the SEC, which was signed by almost 500,000 people, which is absolutely a record by, you know, any standards. I mean, not many people frequent the SEC website to sign a petition, would require that publicly traded corporations give shareholders this information. I think, you know, I'll end with where I started, which is that, unfortunately, this may look like the FEC in terms of the commissioners failing to act. There are three Democrats, two Republicans. There's a new chairwoman, Mary Jo White. She's been on the job, I think, for 20 days, and by all accounts, she will be the deciding vote. I'm not sure. There's a lot of opposition to this within the regulated community, and I'm not sure there'll really be action on this.
Why are these big corporations against it? I mean, because they like the option of being able to spend money without having it attributed to them.
Well, I think it's what you said. They don't want to upset any shareholders. And frankly, I think that political spending, a lot of times for corporations, is simply the cost of doing business. So shareholders may see that money spent on both sides to advocate, you know, for opposing candidates. We know from a Supreme Court record about 10 years ago in a case called McConnell that type of behavior is not unusual. And corporations, you know, they're in the business of doing business. They provide services and sell widgets, and they're not particularly inclined to ruffle feathers or, as you said, to, you know, upset the people who really own the stock. And lack of disclosure allows them to hide and to avoid any such controversies.
Just in the last minute, Jessica, was Justice Kennedy naive, thinking that there could be some transparency instead of this all this dark money?
Well, I hope that he was. I hope that what he was simply just a little early in his prediction that there would be transparency. Certainly, his opinion hinges in such large part on the idea that the way we're going to prevent corruption or the appearance of corruption is just to give everyone all the information, not to put limits on the amount of money that's spent, but to just say to the public, here's who's spending the money, now you decide for yourselves.
But that's not happening.
That has absolutely not happened. I hope that it does happen.
Somebody's going to have to make it happen. It's not going to happen on its own.
It's not going to happen on its own, and we're going to have to see a lot more political bravery from members of regulatory agencies.
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, Jessica Levinson.
Thank you so much for having me.
Again, I've been speaking with Jessica Levinson, who's a professor at Loyola Law School, where she focuses on election law and governance issues, including campaign finance, ethics, and state budgets. She wrote an amicus brief for the Supreme Court in McCormish versus Bennett, the case in which John Roberts and four other justices ruled to limit public funding in elections. She's also the editor of the blog politics.blogspot.com and has an article at the Sacramento Bee, Will the SEC Save Us from Citizens United? This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Nick Garino. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.